Hey, this is Bob Lee, and you're listening to Over the Ball with Kevin Flynn, the world's game from an American perspective.
Over the Ball is brought to you by Soccer America. Soccer America, the soccer paper of record. Go to SoccerAmerica.com and sign up for your subscription today. And by Nella from FitBiomics. A Harvard doctor has found a probiotic strain that is found in most world-class athletes. Not all probiotics are the same. More information on all our sponsors at overtheball.com/sponsors.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Over the Ball with Kevin Flynn and Chris Chamonix. Well, U.S. Women's National Team, a loss to a B-side in Spain. They've lost to England. Are the wheels coming off the bus for the U.S. women? More people losing their jobs after the Yates report. Pulisic in a rare start puts one in the back of the net. Ricardo Pepe finds the back of the net twice. A lot to talk about today. So, Chris, up first, this is kind of shocking news with the U.S. Women's National Team. A lot of the B.A. team on the Spanish side were, sitting it out in protest. The B-side comes on, and they beat our U.S. women. Look, this is something we've been talking about for a while, Chris. Parity now around the world a little closer to parity. And when the women play in CONCACAF, it doesn't really prepare them for some of these games. What are you thinking?
Yeah, it's come a long way in a short amount of time. We were talking to someone this week about, you know, if you were a woman and played soccer and you wanted to go pro back in the day, if it wasn't in the U.S., you only had one destination, which was Sweden. And now that is just mushroomed into so many leagues across the world, and the parity and the resources have really multiplied. And so now you have more and more teams. Every time we have a World Cup, there's more and more teams that can play with and or beat the U.S. And that list just continues to grow. Spain is certainly on that list now, and there's many in Europe who can. And so the days of just simple U.S. domination are over. I think we have to be, we're one of the horses, but we are a horse, but we're one of, not just the sole.
Well, I think, you know, our women sort of started it all. There's even an article in New York Times about, you know, the women's national team getting their money that they demanded. And that has inspired other teams around the world to say, yeah, why not us? And if you don't pay them, it's kind of tough to defend that argument. But we've talked about it on this show quite a bit about how, you know, we had the athletes and we had the skill long before a lot of these other countries were starting to play. And I think it gave a sort of a misconception that the women dominated this sport, and they did, but there wasn't much competition worldwide. So this is basically what you're saying as well, is these other countries have caught up. Unfortunately, in CONCACAF, our region here where the women play, you know, they're playing teams that are sort of ill-equipped to play at that level, where women are just getting some basic human rights or the right to play the game. So we've talked about, you know, the Arsenals and the PSGs, everybody that has their women's team over there. They get to take advantage of the infrastructure from the men's team, and they're training at a high level year round. And a lot of our women are going over there. What would you think the percentage of our women going across the pond would be?
Yeah. I mean, it's roughly 50-50. I think the idea that, you know, hey, would love to live in America. I think a lot of the American women feel that way. A lot of the European players would like the experience to live in America. All that's fine. But there's also an allure to go put on a shirt that says Barcelona, that says Arsenal, you know, all that stuff. So, you know, stepping into those countries that is football fanatics, and where it's the one and only sport that leads the storyline every single day, there's something to be said if you're a soccer person dipped in a culture like that. It's very satisfying. So to be a big player on a team in that culture, it's very appealing. And that's why the NWSL is a really important crossroads here to reestablish itself as one of the best leagues and a safe place for players and coaches. And right now this is a hit, and it could be something that Europe runs away with and takes the lead on.
Yeah, this is, you know, so NWSL is in the news with the Yates report, obviously. And, you know, the numbers of attendance are not great. They do have a TV deal. Do you think this all comes, the Yates report all comes at a bad time for women's soccer? You know, I wanted to talk to you about the under 17 women. They're looking for some sort of redemption. They haven't been successful of late, you know, with the 17 and under. So do you think this is just kind of a bad time in the sense of people are just catching up to them?
Well, it's odd because some of the stories that have come out of the report have been going on for quite a while. And so, you know, the problems here have been there apparently for years and years. And now it's finally only with this report that it's all coming to a head all at the same time. And it's going to rattle the league and it's going to rattle the sponsors. The sponsors deserve a lot of credit because they haven't just abandoned the product. They've actually turned their resources towards the actual Women and Players Association, and they're trying to support them in different ways, more creative ways, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if the league appears to be kind of taking a shot here, then you might see players more inclined to go sign with European leagues. And the NWSL can't afford that because part of the allure is to live and play in America, and they need to win those quote unquote recruiting battles against players who would potentially go overseas.
And part of it's also follow the money. You know, you're talking about, we were talking about the Miami quarterback who just, they put him back in the game after an obvious concussion that just, they wanted to win the game. They didn't really care about the guy's health. Always follow the money. And I think they're making their money over there, you know, overseas. Now they're joining these elite teams. And I just feel like the NWSL just never quite is able to keep momentum going. You know, for a whole variety of reasons. So it just seems like some, you know, then the national team's losing now, which, you know, NWSL is a big supporter and a feeder of talent to them, as well as the colleges. But it just feels like it's starting to drift away a little bit. I don't know if that's just my read into it, but it feels like their opportunity is drifting away. And the other thing is, you know, I think like a Megan Rapinoe just, you know, comments on owners saying that they're unfit to run a team. They haven't had a trial or a jury or anything. And I just don't think, I think it's great to speak out. She's been rewarded for speaking out quite a bit, I believe. But sometimes you don't factor in all the other things that need to be considered when you're saying the owner too, I don't know. So just some dark days, it seems.
Yeah, there's a really good show, E60 episode on ESPN. It's called Truth Be Told, that documents all this stuff in real time up to the Yates report that just came out. When you look at the history and the launches of different women's leagues, and two or three have not worked out, but this one kind of has worked out in conjunction with US soccer and all the different, you know, ways that they've been able to create financial packages to keep the league afloat. There's a startup quality to it that in theory they've grown out of a little bit. Having said that, they're still at these places now where in a story like this comes out, you have to shine light on what the problems are in order to build forward. And if that means one step back before it's two steps forward, so be it. But these women cannot be in these situations where it's unsafe to play.
Yeah. It's the sexual stuff that the harassment and stuff that really jumps out at people and takes their imagination, you know, about the what people had to sort of endure. It seems like a lot of it also is, and we talked about this last week, emotional abuse or psychological abuse, which is that a new thing? Because I don't hear about it in MLS. You don't hear about it in NFL. Occasionally you might hear, I don't know, I don't think you hear about it in the NBA, but here we are hearing about it in women's soccer. Is that a sort of a sexist take on it?
I think when you have a really professional league, especially ones that have been around for a long time, you understand that it's a professional workplace. And if it's quote unquote the NFL, it's men talking to men in that situation. And there's a direct adult to adult way of working. Okay, maybe it gets impassioned because it's within the umbrella of sport, but you still talk to each other in a professional way. And that's what has to exist as well in all leagues across all sports, including any women's league across any sport. We still need coaches to conduct themselves professionally in that situation. It's not a green light for excess. And that's the part where I think that's what's popping off the page out of this report is all the excess of verbal abuse beyond the scope of coaching or a firm coach or holding someone to accountability. If it becomes personal and negative and repetitive, that's never okay.
Like I know. And and we talked about this last week as well. I just know that just the way there's this sort of the cancel culture that we have now, the sort of woke culture that we have now, to be in a locker room is not a very PC place to be, or it wasn't when I was playing. Now, it certainly has changed. I understand that, and that's what you're saying. But part of this verbal abuse, it was a part of coaching. It's certainly not your style. It's not what you consider professional, but I, you know, he's Joe Maroney from UConn throwing clipboards and yelling at players, and even as players that weren't his, you know, and
maybe so, but that was 30 years ago. If you go in the NFL today, that stuff isn't happening. You think coaches are yelling at players like that where it's personal time and time again? No way.
Well, the only problem now is they say with professionals is they're all millionaires. So they generally make as much or more than the coach and they don't want to listen to it. You know, like I said, with my Calipari quote where he said, you can chew out a professional athlete once or twice a year, maybe, right. You know, but here we're talking college and, you know, look.
Yeah, but that chewing out once or twice a year, that he's saying that for a reason. And it's the same exact kind of situation in a women's team or in a women's league. It's like,
right.
You know, you raise your voice maybe to make a point here and there, but that's part of maybe the passion of coaching. But it can't get personal and it can't be repetitive because everyone's going to tune that out.
Right.
Different than a kid and a parent or, you know, a student and a teacher. Like that dynamic over time, we've learned hasn't worked. And so you don't see it in the NBA that way. You don't see it in the NFL. If anything, you see it because maybe they're in each other's hair every single day. And sometimes they get fed up with each other. But it's not a repetitive type of thing, which is Calipari's point, which is the exact point that we should be using here in the NWSL. And coaches with the right amount of experience know that. And that's where I think this has been really alarming to see coaches being put in these situations who are using these ideas and tactics and how, you know, separate from the sexual abuse, the verbal abuse, if you look at just the verbal abuse, how there's not even a place for that either, because it doesn't lead to better success. It just doesn't.
Right. We got to let Bobby Knight know. So, but what I thought was interesting now is the Orlando Pride coaches, Amanda Cromwell and Sam Green, who are UCLA people, so they must be in your group. I'm sure you know them. This has been interesting because they've come back out and said they completely disagree with the findings and are considering, you know, suing. And so that's part of it. Everybody that was a sort of taken to task last week, guys, people lost their jobs for asking a woman if perhaps sleeping with him was on their bucket list. Which is a creepy kind of thing to say. So here it is now. Now this is the first woman named. And we did mention the woman who ran the NWSL. She will probably be reprimanded or I don't know if she's out of the game. But they're basically appealing this, saying they just, you know, Amanda Cromwell just disagrees.
Yeah, a couple things. I mean, I want to even go back to like the Bobby Knight thing that mentioned. Mm-hmm. Like as a coach coming up, you know, you read and you study all these different coaches across all different sports. Like I unplugged from all his stuff a long, long time ago. Cause like, I wouldn't want to play for a guy like that. I wouldn't want my kids to play for a guy like that. There's an old school version of that. And I understand the value of accountability and structure, but you can create that without the physicality and abuse and machismo, like all that stuff is actual nonsense. When you really peel it back, it's not how professionals work. Now in a college landscape where you're the king, you can get away with that crap. But in a professional environment, you can't, that's why he doesn't go to the NBA. You can't get away with that in the
right.
NBA.
That's well, and
these
then
guys don't work in the NBA.
And the coach that I loved to read about was John Wooden, who had a very opposite approach. Yeah. Total nurturing, opposite. Nurturing, work on fundamentals. You know, we're a team. You're not an individual. I think you'll enjoy the results, that whole thing.
Yeah. And by the way, his team were full of assassins. You know what I mean? So you can get there. You just have to be evolved and smart, not just doing all this other nonsense.
You know, but anyway. Another thing in Soccer America that I was reading is the under 17s have struggled recently, the women. Now, that really surprised me that they've struggled, especially when they dominated for so long at the full nationals team side. And here they are struggling, the under 17s. Do you have a theory as to why that would be?
You know, I really don't. I mean, obviously at the youth level where producing as many good players else as anywhere else. There's always the argument on the boy side that our players are not as technical as some of the other boys out there in the world who are being developed in different countries in different ways. I wonder if that's caught up a little bit on the women's side as well. And maybe at that age group, maybe other teams are a little bit more technical. I put up my hand and say that I'm not sure I'm knowledgeable enough on this one to say. But it's something to watch. I know some of the players who are on the under 17 pool. I know them to be athletic and super pacey and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, how that can be harnessed and developed into technical players as well, because you're going to need both at the highest levels to be determined. But I also think it's just a matter of parity around the world. That's all. It's catching up not only with the first team, but down to the youth national teams as well.
Yeah, I remember watching in France the under 17s play for, and the two best teams by far were Scotland and Spain. And I said to Craig Burley over at ESPN, I said, what happens to the full Scottish side? He goes, it's the drink. They all start, the drink and women and booze and smoking and everything else starts to happen when you're 18, and he says, we kind of start to lose them. So, which goes to Christian Pulisic's point where he was like 13 to 16 is a really key time for the development of a player. So speaking of Christian Pulisic, how's that for a segue there, Chamonix? Yeah. He got a rare start this weekend. I got to tell you, did you watch the Chelsea game?
No, I didn't get to see it this weekend.
Okay, so he gets his first start. He is effective right away. He's making those sort of dashing runs. He plays positive. He really does. He goes forward at a clip. You know, he got that change of pace, that cut in and move. The color announcer was just all over his shit. Just, saying he's really not. I'm like, it was him on that side and Azpilicueta on the other side creating all these chances, and yet he could not get his due from the English announcer. And it was pissing me off. My fists were bald. It was like, and then he scored a goal and he says, well, that's overdue. Overdue, why? Because he had two or three other opportunities that he created that didn't finish, and he finally finished one, and they went up 2-0. So I think there's still an anti-American bias over there. The player you really start at like -5. So you got to work your way up. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think all the Americans in other leagues have a little bit of a steep climb for respect and the ability to impact the game. I think Pulisic, it'll be interesting to see, because when he's with the U.S., he tends to have to carry more water, and I don't think that's his best. I think he's at his best when he's in a really good team and can just have a small role. When the field is kind of spread out and they're not keeping.
If I could just interject, I think he's carrying less water than he had to before. Seems like there are more tools around him, That's a bad way to put it, actually. On the U.S. team, you have Musa, for the national team. He's got, you got some people, Weah, they're guys who are.
Maybe so, but remember that. Maybe a few more tools, but not played in, not together, not a lot of synchronicity there. They're a national team, not a club team. And so just that alone tends to slow them down because they're a little bit more, they're not as dialed in as a club team would be. And so that slows the game down. When that slows the game down, he's not at his best. So there's a slippery slope there between when he's at his best and when he's not. And that leads to frustration amongst the fans. But I think the better the team is, and I've had many, many players who, when you put them on a team and they're one of the top five players, they underperform, relatively speaking, compared to if you had that same player in a team where they were player number 10, 11, 12, all of a sudden they have a bigger role and a bigger impact in the game because it's the style of the team suits them better. How much water they have to carry, quote unquote. And that's a real thing.
Well, he played well. I thought he got a goal. So hopefully, gets a few more starts this week. I wanted to ask you this too, watching Fulham play and Tim Ream, they lost, but Ream's a central defender and he's playing at that level every single week. He seems, I remember Greg Kenny, one of my friends, is a coach. He goes, I need one superstar to score some goals, and then I need 10 other players to just play, support, And I felt like with Tim Ream, you get a good, steady performance from him pretty much consistently. I think when he's on the outside back, it's a little sketchy because he doesn't have the wheels for it. But inside, I think he could be paired off with Zimmerman. What do you think?
That wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, I think he's worn the captain's band at Fulham as well. He's been there a long time. He's played at the highest levels in England. If you needed right before the World Cup to cut and paste and say the Aaron Long thing is not working out, we need someone to step in on short notice, arguably he's the name, to put in there.
Yeah.
And on short notice, I understand why. He's a little older, maybe a bit slower than some of the other options. But where we are right now, you can make an argument that he's the best selection.
Interesting. Now, I don't know why he wasn't even on the roster last time. So, and John Brooks seems to be out. Aaron Long, I don't think, is back fully from that knee surgery. He's just not doing it. I don't think Zimmerman has been my boy for a couple of years now. He brings that real physical presence. And Ream, I think, breaks some lines with some of his passes, especially when he's you know, at the center back position. So
yeah, I think the program, the national team program, has tilted towards the younger player, mm-hmm. the super dynamic, super athletic player, and they have many of those players across all different positions. So in that sense, all respect to Tim Ream, but he doesn't fit that profile. But he does fit, he does check other boxes, and he does bring a certain stability to the position. He may not win you the game, but there's a good chance he's not going to lose you the game. And you got to think about at what point does that have more value than plan B. So I'd be curious to see how they look at him. I think he should be in the group so that they have that option. Mm-hmm. And maybe even given one last look and consideration before they name the final team.
Checked out a bit of the Leeds game. It was a tale of two halves, basically, which our game always is. Leeds looked fantastic the first 45 minutes and then sort of ran out of gas that second half. But it was good to see Tyler Adams and Aaronson sort of playing, you know, all these guys. Manchester United was interesting. You know, all the talk was about Ronaldo sitting on the bench, and he comes off the bench in the first half and scored one. I mean, the guy's a machine. He just wants to score so badly when he's out there. But I don't know if that always, you know, certainly doesn't. He's not doing it for the team, if that makes any sense. You know, he seems like
700 goals.
Oh, 700th goal.
And he's played for the biggest teams in Europe. He's not doing it, you know, in these ancillary leagues. You look at his record. It's amazing. He played something like over 400 games for Real Madrid and scored more than a goal a game for them.
You know,
and this is during the Barcelona prime days.
Yeah.
You know, so he's still doing it across all levels. And even the bold choice to come back to Man United, which a lot of players would not have done that.
Right.
He's still, if you look at his games played and his goals, he's still scoring at a remarkable clip.
Yeah, he led them in scoring last year. I mean, he's an amazing player. Now, there's talk of him coming to MLS. You think it's time, or does he have more at that level?
I think he thinks that he can still do more at that level. I think he'd rather not come here until he has to. And I think he is in a race with Messi to still score the most goals, score the most Champions League goals, to still try to finish with as many notches above Messi as he can. That's a real thing. And, you know, Messi doesn't seem to need to slow down. I'm curious what the next chapters are, because Mbappe today is talking about how things are not working at PSG. So he'll put his foot down and probably end up at Real Madrid in January. And so now Real Madrid will in effect have Benzema and Vinicius and...
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And Mbappe. And then who's to say that Messi doesn't go back to Barcelona? And if he goes back to Barcelona, maybe Neymar goes with him. And now they've got...
It's like playing checkers talking to you. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And that would be an amazing, fun chapter. And and maybe I'm saying all this stuff because I miss Messi's Barca against Ronaldo's Real Madrid.
Real Madrid, yeah. We all do.
Close to doing that. If you look at how PSG's playing recently, it's with wingbacks and two midfielders and three forwards. They're basically saying, we can't get the three of you guys to defend. So, you know, you guys sit up top and we'll do all that work. And I don't know if that's going to be sustainable in Champions League. And so
too much of a good thing.
Yeah, that team might blow up a little bit. And if it does, these players start scattering and going into different directions. Messi ends back up at Barcelona. We could have a nice, we could be in a different world come January.
All right. So you say no go with Ronaldo coming here, and I hope he doesn't wait too long. So one guy putting the ball in the back of the net, Ricardo Pepe, he had two goals this past weekend. He seems to be hitting his stride. I mean, look, Chris, you've coached enough young people. It's, you know, people like think if you're a player, you can just drop into a situation and start doing what you do because the game's the game, right? It's the same here as it is there. But it's not like that, is it? There's a lot to acclimate yourself with.
Yeah, when you go to a different team in a different country, different coach, different teammates, different style, there's a lot in a short window of time to you know, get acclimated. And sometimes those players, when they transfer, they don't really hit their stride till the second year because now they've got everything squared away, their housing situation squared away, they have a routine and a rhythm, and then they can perform on the field. Yeah, all these things go into it. You know, having said that, you know, PFOC is still doing well, and you have other options as well. So I don't know. I think the storyline is a little bit tired of who the forwards are.
Well, I think
I think so, Chris, because look, we had a really disappointing two matches with the U.S. men's national team. You've talked before in this program about guys hitting their stride at the right time. They all seem to be doing a little something. You know, Jesus is scoring domestically. Pepe's starting to put the ball in the back of the net. Josh Sargent is getting some time, and he seems to have adjusted. And Ricardo Pepe always seems to be a fan favorite. He seems to be a Berhalter kind of inside track guy. So I think if he scored some goals, he's going to be on that squad.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain coaches who see certain players in certain ways, and another player can't necessarily overcome that. What I'm seeing is that there's a threshold on form. Like, form matters, but if you believe player A is greater than player B, well, player B might be in better form, but that doesn't necessarily trump A's gap over B. And so these are decisions in real time that I think our coaches should probably have computed by now. And so that's why I'm saying it's a little tired. Like, let's name the team and let's get going and let's start to make it clear. And we're holding this over their head down to the last game. Did you score in the last game? They're all.
Well, I think he's probably got it in his mind who goes where and when.
Maybe so. And there should be some clarity at this point about who your group is. But I understand that, you got to wait it out for injuries in case something does pop up. So you don't want to show all your cards just yet. So I wonder if on the inside, all the stuff has been communicated already. But we'll see.
Too many question marks this close to the cup. That's what's making everybody nervous, I think. Too many.
There's exactly your Tim Ream question. Like, I think that's a really good question. It's like, why is that not part of this? And, are we having too many questions this late in the cycle? That usually doesn't bode well.
Right. And, we've talked about this before. This is such a weird transition where players generally would sort of bleed out of the team. It was very truncated this time. There was this, the quarantine happened with the virus, and then that kind of put everybody back. Guys aged out during that period. Berhalter was trying to go with the young people and trying to bring them along. And it used to be you keep some of the old people to help the younger ones move in and transition. But that wasn't really made to be, to happen this time around. So it was, it's different. And the cup is at a different time. So, man, we were so kind of up, and then all of a sudden these last two friendlies and Saudi Arabia is a good team though. I was, researching them a little bit yesterday. They beat Japan, who, looked great against the United States. They're winning. They're a good team. And they've definitely grown. They've grown into it. Let me ask you this. I was looking at the list. Did you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I got very distracted once you used the word truncated. I was so impressed by that.
I was going to say bifurcated, but then I just
truncated. That would have been awesome. No, going back to Saudi Arabia, I mean, there's a general point, which is that the world is smaller and smaller with scouting now. So you can go to these countries like a Saudi Arabia, and many of these players are able to play in other leagues now and do well and get great playing experience and development. So some of the smaller countries are not as small as they used to be because their players are actually in good leagues. And it makes them harder to beat. I think Iran is going to be a little bit like that as well. So these teams can be trickier than ever before.
Yeah, and they're all up for it, man, because the World Cup, it's a season in 3 weeks. So,
but what were you going to say? Yeah, you had a question.
The next thing I was going to talk about was I wanted to basically look into this list of MLS longest tenured coaches. So what is the key to longevity? Peter Vermes, I've known him since he was a player. He's a hard ass man. He believes in himself. He believes in a certain way. I remember him yelling at other players in practice for the 94 World Cup. Just if anybody looked or was distracted, he would, yell like, and I thought like, okay, this guy's going to be a coach because he's into the discipline. He's into, maximizing every moment out of practice. What do you think are the reasons for success at that level for that long period of time? I mean, you've worked in the MLS in a lot of different capacities.
Yeah, I think the nature of the ownership group and what the expectations are of the club and the relationship between the manager and the ownership group is unique to each club. And there are certain clubs that are bigger spending clubs, and you see more turnover in the coaching positions. Mm-hmm. And then you have some quote unquote smaller market teams that don't spend as much on players. And they tend to, you know, stick with coaches a little bit longer because they understand each other's, you know, MO. And so with that, you know, Peter Vermes has been there for a really long time, found success, found consistency, and the club in return has made a really big commitment to him over time. And I think we saw that this year when his team, this is the lowest level team he's had in many, many years. So yeah, between DP injuries and whatnot, it just didn't come together. And I was happy to see that they didn't let him go. And that's, I mean, part of the reason why I'm not necessarily agreeing with the Caleb Porter firing. Yeah, you know, I thought,
again, the surprise.
Yeah, I thought that, again, a smaller market team, quote unquote, and he'd done a good job with them. He's brought them to the brink. He can't kick the ball for them. He's brought them to the brink twice. And, you know, I don't know what's going, none of us know what's going on behind the scenes in the locker room. And that is the most important part. But from the outside looking in, he seems to have built some success. And when he doesn't succeed, the wheels don't necessarily fall off. He's close to it. And so it's a little surprising that they made such a drastic change like that, especially him being an Ohio guy and all that stuff.
Right. All right. Let me give you a quick quiz. So I'm going to run down the roster of the guys' names, the coaches, and you give me your just quick response on what kind of coach they are and why they've had longevity there.
Yeah.
All right. So Peter Vermes.
Yeah, firm, creates a real firm culture, knows exactly what he wants, has great relationship with ownership, and has been really shrewd with his signings and have found efficiencies in the league for consistent success, and it's been a good marriage.
Okay, Jim Curtin in Philadelphia.
Jim Curtin's a great guy, a great communicator, a great guy, very likable, has developed as a coach, has gotten his arms around the job, and has found a way to bring along young players who run through walls for him. And he's found consistency with that, with the club support. And he's doing a very good job.
Brian Schmitzer in Seattle, 6 seasons.
Yes, Seattle legend, been there forever. USL days, MLS days, well-entrenched in the community, has a lot of people's respect with how he goes about his business. Doesn't seem to be too high or too low, brings a certain amount of consistency to that team. And they've always signed players. They always have weapons, and he's been able to be a steady hand behind the scenes and keep the success going.
Adrian Heath, Minnesota, 6 seasons. Six seasons probably already there. Wow.
Probably the one I know the least about. Brings a fiery, you know, approach to things. I've watched that Minnesota team play over the last couple of years, and there's times where when they're at their best and they're healthy, I mean, they're one of the better teams in the league. I think they've hit some hurdles here or there and some inconsistent patches and some injuries and whatnot, but they've done a pretty good job that when they have their best roster on the field, he's been able to make them into consistent playoff contenders. So you're going to keep your job.
Right. Bruce Arena. I guess we kind of all know the answer to that one.
Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
It just didn't go right this year. You know, if you coach a number of seasons, it's just not going to go right. He also has the hangover from winning the Supporter Shield, runaway Supporter Shield last year. So you know,
everybody, that was like such a letdown to not win the cup too last year with that team, the way they were playing.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, he's going to complain rightfully that last year he wins Supporter Shield the way that they do. And then they had to wait something like 10, 12 days to play again.
Yeah.
And the amount of time that goes by in our sport, that's not great.
Because we talked about that when that was happening. Cause you know, if you're a player and you take a game off, it feels weird getting back in there the next one. You missed it. You missed one of the whole battles. And I think that definitely hurt them.
Yeah. When you have that much success, it's hard to maintain success in MLS because there's bonuses and numbers change and you move players and then, you know, Turner leaves midway through the year. There's extra distractions.
Yeah.
And so the hangover of that, they, for whatever reason, they couldn't get it off the ground this year.
Well, and then I'm watching Liverpool, and the wheels have come off the bus on Liverpool. I mean, here they were. They were machines. You know, not a different sort of playing style than Man City, but they were consistent. And, man, they just wore you down, and they are just not doing it. They're giving up goals. What's your theory as a coach? Just tired of going to the well too many times?
I think their whole success has been based on counter-pressing and getting pressure on the ball, and that allows them to play a high line and win the ball back and feed their attackers and all that kind of stuff. So many things have happened all at the same time. You know, when you let Mane go to Bayern Munich, now that reinvents the attack. You know, it's one of three prongs, and that's a 33% change to your attack right there. So that's a real thing when someone like that leaves, from a production point of view, from a chemistry point of view, and a flow in the attack. And then you have some injuries in key positions. They've had to play some older players for longer minutes. Some players are out of form. And then all the weaknesses that are always there have been put under the spotlight, because if you can't get pressure on the ball with the way they play and that high line, teams are going to be able to play in and around and behind them. Yeah. And so now you're turning and sprinting at your own goal and bad things happen. So they've been conceding too many goals and haven't been able to control midfield enough.
Yeah, Robertson's out, you know, and the Greek kid is in there now and not as effective, I don't think. Henderson seems to have lost a step. Firmino seems to have lost a step, even though he had a great goal this week. They have Nunes, but Nunes doesn't seem to be as active as Mane. Mane was all over the place and
different profile,
creating all kinds of havoc. Yeah, totally.
Different profile players. They've had unlucky injuries. And then things have added up. Like, you know, you look at Robertson over the last 5 years, I think he's the player. He's either number one or number two in minutes played on that team. Yeah. And they've played so many games and he plays for their national team. So, you know, he's run his legs off a little bit. So now you're playing at 10% less capacity and that accumulates. You can't get pressure on the ball. All these dominoes start to work against you. And all of a sudden, as he said this week, like, we're not even in the title race, Klopp said.
Yeah. And they're not. They're in the middle of the table. Champions League continues. Love this time of year. Really great. Haaland is still just tearing it up. He's, and Bellingham and Mbappe are actually leading for the Golden Boot. So who do you like coming through the Champions League? Is Man City just the pretty much clear winner?
Well, I think Man City is a great stage in their evolution where they've got a lot of players with experience. They've made some changes to the current roster. They've added this beast of a player in Haaland. They've should be in hunger mode when it comes to the Champions League. They've won, the Premier League 4 out of 5 times. So maybe that is a little bit of a routine for them, although they have Arsenal now to compete with. It could be a 2-team race this year. But in the Champions League, let's be honest, that's what they're really going for. That's what Pep is missing in his profile. And this team is very well built for that. They're at a good point of their evolution with the right change of roster players, with the right playmakers, and with a beast of a forward. And you have to have that to win in the league.
Yeah, you think back a year or two ago where Klopp looked like a genius and Pep seemed to be underachieving a little bit with all those horses. You know, didn't win the Champions League, which is, like you said, a big blank spot on his career there. So, and now look what a difference a year makes now. Klopp seems to be struggling domestically and in Champions League. That Arsenal team, I was quite impressed with. They, you know, Arteta's done a great job. They've given him a chance. We talked about this on the show before. This is his team now, and it's playing in his style. And they are, that whole sit back thing doesn't seem to work anymore. These guys are highly skilled players, but they're attacking the ball. They're working really hard for each other in a way that Liverpool used to, really. Now there's spaces, there's gaps. I don't know if it's age or what, but Arsenal, I do not think they're going to win the league. I think it'll be Man City. I think Man City's going to win the league, and I think they're going to win the Champions League as well.
I think what do you think? Yeah, I mean, you know, conventional wisdom is that Man City will win the Premier League, but Arsenal has had pretty much a spotless start to the season.
Yeah.
They have an inexperienced manager and pool of players in terms of the sustainability of this. And this is a long season. So it'll be interesting to see.
With a World Cup in it.
Yes. And that's new for everyone as well. So it'll be interesting to see how they're able to sustain and maintain, because City is right on their heels, even though that, you know, Arsenal's had this fantastic start. It's a 2-team race at this point and City's got the experience. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see who goes further in Champions League, because that could play a factor in, you know, who you think is going to get all the extra games by the end of the spring. If one of those two teams goes out early in the Champions League, that could be the team that actually has the better legs for the Premier League. So it'll be interesting to see. If I had my choice, I'm picking City. I'm, you know, preferential in a few different ways. I like the manager and I like the watching the team play. And I just can't give it to Arsenal yet. I think they have to prove so much more.
Well, it's a long season. Every coach I know loves Pep. Why is that?
I think I'm not convinced he's a great person. I don't know the guy, but
the Mourinho, I tell you that.
I'm not so sure about that.
Really?
I'm not so sure that if we spent time with the two of them, that you wouldn't walk away saying Pep's the better manager and Mourinho's the better guy.
Really?
I've been in the same room with Mourinho at a coaching seminar with, you know, whatever, 30 coaches or something like that, and spent over an hour with the guy, and I'm not, you know, perfect, but I read people pretty well. And I would tell you that that's a good guy and cool. He's not putting on an act and he's got his feet on the ground. Now, I think he puts on a persona to become this Mourinho manager guy that he needs to do to protect his players and to shield his players and to build a swagger into his own coaching profile. But when you put that aside and actually talk to the person, I actually think he's a decent guy. But again, that's one opinion from really 1 or 2 hours of time with someone. Pep, I've not experienced, but I don't know what it is. I think he says all the right things in front of the camera. I think the players, bottom line, have a hard time with him, but he's tactically unbelievable and goes even further than Mourinho does and has evolved the game further than Mourinho.
Good. Talking about tactically unbelievable, how's the team doing?
We're tactically unbelievable.
That's it. Well, your coach is tactically unbelievable, so it just trickles down. It's like the trickle-down theory.
How'd you make out this week? We've lost a few games. The conference is a beast. We've lost a few games. We're hanging in there. We've come a long way. We were talking the other day about how, you know, we've played 11 games. That's 990 minutes, and it's only been 27 minutes of those 990 that were outside the scope of one goal, meaning like we're either tied
right
by one or down by one. So we've made ourselves hard to beat and competitive. We just got to find a way to grab some more wins, but we couldn't be more pleased about how they've embraced it.
Great. So I will get going here in a second, but I don't know if I told you this last week, but I just missed meeting George W. Bush. I was in the waiting area for private jet terminal area.
Yeah.
And I sat down and a guy that I know, cause I was on Nantucket, a guy that I know goes, "Hey man, you just missed George Bush." I go, "Where was he?" He was sitting in the chair you're sitting in right now. He just left. I'm like, damn it. So I was thinking,
what would you have said to him?
Oh, I don't know, but I would seem to come up with something, you know, maybe
come up with a joke.
Well, I don't know if I told the story ever before, but I've met four presidents. All right. And I've talked to four presidents too.
Really?
So the first president I met was George H.W. Bush. George Bush's father. So, you know, who's really this guy, World War II volunteer and, you know, got shot down and real sense of noblesse oblige, you know, this sort of one, you know, the, what that word, way too.
And that's better than truncated. That's truncated. Unbelievable.
Well, most have a truncated sense of noblesse oblige, but it's, you know, I've a hell of a man. And I met him in Portland, Maine. And my friend said, you know, I was doing bits about George W. Bush at the time, who I always thought was a good guy, did the people's work. I disagreed with him on a lot of stuff, but I felt like guy got up and put in a deep, he tried to, you know, make America a better place each morning as he got up to do his work, right, as the president. And I respected that. But I used to do a bit about George W. Bush getting arrested for drunk driving in 1976. I used to say, does anybody remember how drunk you had to be in 1976 to get arrested for drunk driving? I go, it was impossible. You had to get pulled out of the car and flames had a rocket out of your ass. You know, be like, sir, have you been drinking? So, oh my God, you're hammered. You're shit faced. All right. You drive straight home. Okay, pal. You know, take the back roads. They go on the river. Right. So I'm walking with my buddy who's a fighter pilot in the first Gulf War. And he said, Mr. President, it's Scott. And he goes, hey, Scott, calls him sober. And we walk over. Secret Service is around him and everything. And he says, oh, Mr. President, how are you? This is my friend, Kevin Flynn. He's a comedian at the Portland Comedy Connection. He goes, he does a couple of jokes about your son. And George H.W. Bush turns to me and goes, oh, really? Let's hear it.
Oh, boy.
I'm like, I look at my buddy. I'm like, I'm going to punch you in the head. So I told him the joke about the drunk driving in 1970. And he howled. And he goes, well, he really was hammered that night. I just think it's great. So anyway, George W., I wanted to basically tell him that story. I don't know how it would have gone over with him very well.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was fun.
Who were the other ones you met?
Well, George H.W. was the first one I met. I met Bill Clinton. I talked to him for 20 minutes about peace in Northern Ireland, which I know nothing about, but I was just in my zone. Met a President Obama. Mm. And somebody said, he wasn't president at the time. He was running. I went there as a John Edwards fan. We all know how that turned out. I would have been better off being Jonathan Edwards fan. And then Trump. I met Trump, too. Mm. But with Obama, someone said, you know, during his campaign, he said, oh, yeah, he's a comedian. He goes, oh, you have any jokes about me? I said, well, yeah, I have one. And he goes, oh, come on, let me hear it. And I go, all right. So I like Obama, this guy who's running. He's challenging white people to understand black rage. And he's asking white people to understand black rage. And he's asking black people to understand white resentment and rage. And if we can understand these two things as a country, we can begin to understand my first marriage. And he laughed. Yeah. And then he looks at me, he goes, well, that's really not about me too much. No, I go, no, yeah, it's not a joke about you. He goes, oh, I thought I was really going to get it here. And I'm like, no, that's the only joke I got so far. He was tough to write jokes on. He really was.
Yeah. Glad the narcissism came out.
Yeah.
So who of the four had the most comedic sense, in your opinion?
The most comedic sense? I say Bill Clinton, because we were laughing. Because he said something to me. I said, Mr. President, with the name Kevin Flynn and the Irish flag flying overhead, I said, I just want to thank you for initiating peace over in Northern Ireland. And he said, Kevin, I literally just got off the phone this instant with Tony Blair. And do you know what Tony Blair said to me, Kevin? And I said, Mr. President, I have absolutely no idea what Tony Blair just said to you in the car on the way here. And he laughed. He goes, well, I guess you would. Very funny, Kevin. And he puts his hand on my shoulder. He's like, Kevin, Kevin, Kevin. And we're talking. And I'm like, oh, my God, this guy's good. Yeah. But I wanted a picture with him. And after we had talked for 20 minutes, and it's a long story, I'm standing next to Brad Whitford from Aerosmith, who was with me. And it was like, I ask after we finish our 20-minute conversation, I turn to my friend and go, did you take a picture? He goes, no, I was just listening to you guys. I'm like, listening to what, you idiot? So about an hour goes by and I try to line up and see the president again because I want a picture with him. And he walks over and he goes, ah, Kevin, my Irish friend. I'm like, wow, this guy's good. It's an hour later, you know, a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I said, Mr. President, I forgot to tell you, I watched the Republican National Convention last night with Bill Murray, the comedian, because I was shooting a movie with him.
Yeah.
And it is like he got hit with a dart gun. He goes, he stopped, but it's a big man. But whoop, what? He goes, Kevin, you know Bill Murray, the comedian? He goes, you friends with Bill Murray, the comedian? And I knew him for like, you know, I worked with him like 8 hours the day before. Yeah. And I'm like, yes, I do, Mr. President. Yes, right. I do. He goes, Kevin, will you do me a favor? He goes, will you tell Bill Murray, the comedian, I want to play golf with him? And I said, Mr. President, I said, I just met you and you're already asking me for favors. This is weird.
Good one.
And he laughed. He goes, okay, listen to that, asking for a favor. Did you just hear this guy, Kevin? So I got my jokes off and and actually Bill Murray played golf with the president the next day on Martha's Vineyard. So I called the Farrelly brothers. So next time I see Bill Clinton, I'm going to say, Mr. President, you owe me one.
Well played. Well played. Yeah. And Clinton was a big soccer fan. He was a part of the World Cup bid process and all that kind of stuff.
He got it. He got it. So, all right, brother. Well, this is good. That's all the time we have today on OTB. Folks, a lot of soccer coming up this week. I'm enjoying watching Leeds play. I hope Jesse gets the boys to play 90 minutes at that rate. Win some games there because I'd like to see them do really, really well. That's one of my teams now. We can all root for Leeds. American coach, a couple good American players. As we move towards this weird, wonderful World Cup we're going to have in November, it's coming up, folks. So listen right here on Over the Ball. We'll be talking about a lot of the issues, and we're going to have a lot of fun during the Cup as we always do. All right, everyone. That's all the time we have today on OTB. For Chris Chamonix, I'm Kevin Flynn, and we'll talk to you next time on OTB.
Call or text us at 424-229-2247. That's 424-229-2247.